If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
I'm John Williams. Producer Pete's here, and Stephen Esposito is too, the president of Yellowstone Wealth Management. It's in Lake Forest. Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, John, thank you for having me.
We just heard the news that the president is serious come Wednesday, the 25% tariff on cars and even car parts, so as to encourage domestic production. What's your read on that?
I think it's obviously not a surprise. We knew it was all coming. It's been telegraphed for months now. And the market's, I think, reacting accordingly. But I think it has more to do with the uncertainty of what it'll do to the economy and the system rather than, you know, the effect itself. I mean, we don't know. We don't know how it's going to handle it. There's already companies, some are moving up, some are moving down. But we're not sure how long it'll last either. I mean, he says for the rest of his presidency, but we don't know. It depends on what kind of deals he can cut with those car makers overseas.
Yeah, we've seen him flip-flop on ideas and right. policies, but if this is permanent and the idea is to get more production done domestically, including the very materials that go into those, I wonder what the lag time would be. That is, if we all thought this is absolutely necessary and a good idea, I still wonder if the markets would be reacting any differently. How long before I would actually see a reduction in car prices, because I imagine we're going to see an uptick?
That's a very good point. My understanding, I read a piece recently that a lot of car companies overall are only operating about 60% of capacity. So whatever time it takes for them to convert some of these other idle facilities to produce what they need here, I'm sure they're already on it. They've been talking about it for months. So I think the car companies are in position to do that. The question is, like you said, when? If they get it done, you know, by spring, or not spring, we're at spring, but, you know, let's say 4th of July started to get a lot, you'll see the movement, the market will start to react. But remember, the market's a forward-looking mechanism. I think a lot of this is built in. I'm not sure how much lower we could go here. I think there's some opportunities, but I think it's being way overblown. I really do. The market coming down. But we'll see. I don't know. We'll find out.
Understood. But you did just say you don't think the market can go much lower than it is right now. I know what you meant by that, but that's an interesting statement.
Well, you know, it's an interesting stat out there right now. I read last week, and it's about 2-3 weeks old. The American Association of Individual Investors does their survey, and I've been following this for as long as I can remember, probably 40 years. And it's a pretty good contrarian indicator. And the stats we got in the last 3 weeks were that the amount of bearish sentiment is the highest it's been. There's only one other time it's been higher since 1987. If you could believe that. Go back to, you know, between here and 1987. And the last time it was over 55% was March of 2009. And if you remember, that was the height of the banking crisis. That's when banks and investment firms were being seized. Remember, GM was going bankrupt. Those were scary times. But investor sentiment is so negative right now that it eclipses what happened in 9/11. It eclipses what happened in the 1990s SNL crisis. I mean, so people are pretty bearish. When you have roughly 60% of investors are negative between now and August, that tells you a lot of people are out of this market, and it's a great contrarian indicator. I remember 09. I'm sure you do, too. It was scary times. But for people to be more afraid today than they were any time in the last 38 years, I think is a little ridiculous.
So,
especially economic data you look at, we're getting good economic numbers here. Inflation's coming down. We have $7 trillion sitting in money markets right now. So emotion is running a little hot.
So what do you do with that contrarian sentiment then?
I think it's absolutely a buying indicator. I mean, again, one time have you seen it this bad. And if you go back to that period of time, and look, if you could go back in time and buy, that was a great time to buy. And I think right now, I don't think you just put, you know, throw darts at a stock page, but I think you look at the market in general and look at, I think, consumer discretionary companies, which are getting hit because of it. You look at some of the tech names. You know, I've been worrying about the tech. It's a huge percentage of the market. I think that's another problem, John, that's undermining the market. The big tech leaders that we basically communicated could do no wrong. Many of them around 20, 40, 50% off their highs. So that's undermining confidence simultaneously. And the uncertainty. And people have profits. And when you have profits and you're scared, you automatically pull back a little bit. You reallocate. And I think that's what it is right now. I think that's all it is, to be honest with you. That's it.
Would you reallocate then to NVIDIA, or who are some of these tech companies we're talking about? Is it like the Alphabets of the world as well?
You know, it's funny that I'm right now looking at so many of them. I'm just trying to narrow down what I can buy, but so many of them have come into a buy range now because what used to be, you know, they're coming into actually reasonable multiples right now. And looking at that, it's becoming very attractive to me. I'm also looking at the technical side. Where is support in many of these companies? Because I do think the computers are playing a major role here. But if you look at the bank sector, the financials, interest rates are where they are. That's fine for the banks.
Yeah.
Plenty of, so there's so many. Here's the kid. Right now, I feel like a kid in a candy store because so many of these companies have gone so far. And I do think the future is bright if we can get the act together in the United States and we can bring down the debt and we can build more here, which is the byproduct of what's going on here. That could help the U.S. consumer. And if we can get the tax cuts or that the president's talking about at some point. So I would look out 1 to 2 years, not 1 to 2 quarters as an investor. And I think there's some really good opportunities. I really do.
Stephen Esposito is the president of Yellowstone Wealth Management in Lake Forest, yellowstone.com. Nice to talk to you today, Stephen.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Okay, Bree Fowler, senior writer at CNET. You're going to give me a signal tutorial?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely the hot app right now for many reasons.
I just signed up. In fact, it said, do you want us to automatically include your contacts? And I said, yes. I have 1,762 contacts on my phone. I'm like, I don't know if I want to do all of that. I put in my phone number. It's funny because the tagline when you sign up says, take privacy with you. Be yourself in every message. Well, they sort of were to a fault in that Signal exchange. But what should we know about Signal, Bree?
Yeah, you got to be careful with that contact list if you've got that many people in there. As we found out, adding the wrong person can get you in hot water. Signal is an encrypted messaging app. It prides itself on privacy and security. Everything is encrypted. So in the event that a message were to be intercepted, it would be scrambled and useless if it was received by, you know, someone who wasn't supposed to have it. And, you know, you can set chats up. You can have them self-destruct after a certain amount of time. And, you know, honestly, it's a great way to manage big group chats.
Yeah. Well, relative to what happened here, I don't know that you can answer this, but if there's 18 or 19 people in a group chat, does the name or identity of the person display, or if they're not in my contacts, does it just appear as a phone number? How transparent is the communication when you're in a group chat on Signal?
It depends on the setting. You can cloak yourself, you can hide it, you can, you know, just have the phone number show up. You know, it's good to know who you're dealing with. You know, when I use Signal, I use it as a reporter a lot because it is safe and secure, especially when you compare it to just texting. And, you know, as long as your device stays secure, the communications usually stay secure, too.
What do you mean, as long as your device stays secure?
Well, I mean, it's on your phone. So if someone has access to your phone and your PIN or whatever you use to log in, they can see what's on your screen or what's in the app, just like, you know, they could in any other app. What, you know, where it is secure is in transit. You know, if somebody were able to intercept the messages, they're generally not readable, at least for the purposes of your average consumer, regular person kind of thing. You know, that said, this is absolutely something that government and high profile people and people that are leading businesses where the stakes are much higher, you should absolutely not be using something like this.
Really? Because encrypted to me is the silver bullet. That's what you want. It's encrypted. Other people can't access it. So what's the flaw then?
Well, encryption is a prerequisite. It's not a cure-all. Definitely, it makes it a lot harder to get into these messages, but there are different grades of encryption. You know, something like this is definitely under attack by hackers, nation states especially. You know, countries like Russia would like nothing more than to get into the Signal account or messages of someone very high up in the U.S. government. You know, that their devices, their computers, their phones, that is all being targeted. And that's why, you know, they're supposed to use certain kinds of military and government grade encryption and devices and things like that, that, you know, really is a normal person you don't need access to.
Does it work and have the functionality of texting or WhatsApp or something that we're more familiar with?
Yeah, WhatsApp is actually the same kind of thing. It works pretty much the same way. WhatsApp is also encrypted and, you know, is considered private and secure. Signal is kind of more of a work-related kind of thing, although you can use it, you know, for group chats and to talk to friends and things like that. And just like WhatsApp, I mean, if you're in a group where there are both iPhone and Android, it takes care of the problems, you know, with the bubbles in different ways, things like that.
Yeah.
Irons out those compatibility issues that we all get annoyed with.
I want to ask you about TikTok, but is there anything else you think I should know just to be generally informed about Signal?
No, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, they really do put a lot of effort into security and privacy. You know, they are the good guys. But, you know, if you're a top government official, this is definitely not something you should be using for work.
TikTok and tariffs. So what's the status of TikTok's sale to a U.S. company? I thought that thing was done a long time ago. Is that still in play?
Oh, yeah. When Trump first got into office, he signed that 75-day extension. And we are about 75 days into the Trump administration now. The deadline is now April 5th, which is the end of next week. So TikTok needs to find a buyer to sell itself to that the U.S. government is cool with, or they have to hope that maybe Trump will extend this deadline again, which is entirely possible.
Well, then what's a... Somebody needs to redefine the word deadline, but but is it possible that the president is using the tariffs with China as a way to get them to sell it to a U.S. company?
Yeah, he made comments actually this week that, you know, maybe he would consider reducing tariffs on China if it approved the sale of TikTok. The thing is that China has control over TikTok, which is, you know, part of the reason that the U.S. government and people here have a problem with it. China has not been cool with the sale of TikTok. It wants to keep that algorithm and that app, which is extremely profitable, in-house. And it has said that it will oppose the sale. So, yeah, that there definitely needs to be some leverage and some push-pull there. That's going to happen.
How much would that cost? Is that Elon Musk money? Is that somebody I don't know about money? Who has the resources to buy 50% or more of that?
Well, there have been bids floated. You know, groups of investors, you know, one of the Shark Tank guys wanted to get in. There's, you know, different groups and investors that have floated bids. Also companies, Oracle, I think, came up at one point. But, you know, it's one of those things that's hard to put a value on because it's social media and, mm-hmm. you know, it's not like a publicly traded company where you can look at the regulatory filings and the quarterly statements and figure out how much it's worth.
And it's also not clear that they want to sell it anyway. So there's
right.
that. Okay. Well, do follow that and do visit with us again soon. Thank you very much, Bree Fowler.
Thanks a lot.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Earlier this week, we talked about how to evaluate your staff. One suggestion about that was to find a way to rank the performers and then figure out who you're going to keep. And Aki Ito is writing about the same sort of thing. She is the chief correspondent at Business Insider. BusinessInsider.com. The headline in the article is "What Musk Zuckerberg Get Wrong About Firing Low-Performing Employees." Hi, Aki. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
What did they get wrong?
Well, you know, I think there's this overwhelming belief that's spreading throughout Silicon Valley and much of corporate America right now that, you know, CEOs got too soft on employees, especially during the pandemic. And now they're trying to light a fire under their employees. They're like, it's time to end quiet quitting, you know, and we're going to fire everybody who's not meeting our standards. And intuitively, I think this makes sense. You know, a lot of us, I think, believe that fear does motivate us to, you know, do the kind of things you don't typically like to do, like work hard. But all of the research actually shows that this is an incredibly destructive process. And if anything, it makes people perform worse than better.
You wrote 2025 is shaping up to be the year of the low performer. That is a bad year for the year of the low performer because they're going to get fired. And you're now telling me that's counterproductive. How so? If you get rid of the low hanging fruit, how does that not help the company?
So the, you know, the belief is that a lot of CEOs have is not just that they need to get rid of their low performers, but by getting rid of their low performers, they're, you know, inspiring or, you know, maybe motivating their other employees, their surviving employees to work harder as well. They're trying to instill fear. And that's the thing that's really destructive about this, because that's not really how human motivation works. You know, most studies, what they show is that, sure, you know, if you try to instill this kind of, you know, low performance fear into employees, they temporarily do work faster. Because, you know, they're working faster, that rushed output ends up becoming shoddier. It's lower quality work. And on top of that, it makes them less creative and innovative. They're coming up with fewer ideas.
Yeah, really, maybe you want to take fewer risks if it's received badly, or if the risk doesn't pay off, then you might be shown the door. I want to read what you wrote. As decades of rigorous research have demonstrated, aggressive efforts to raise the bar on performance, as Zuckerberg put it, tend to backfire with remarkable consistency. CEOs may think they're creating a meritocracy, but in reality, they are marching their companies straight into a trap of sunken morale, high turnover, depressed profits, and reduced innovation. I think there's two things that are going on here. One is, if somebody is not a good employee, then there's no reason for you to keep them, or at least there may be a reason for you to try and improve them. But if they're not improvable, if they don't meet the standards, if they're not good for your company, then you should not keep them. But it sounds like, I don't think it was Vivek Ramaswamy. Who was it that just said the bottom 10% get fired? Let's just make it easy. And that sort of blanket attitude is what would be counterproductive, right?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, anytime you set an arbitrary numerical target like that, you know, that's always going to end up involving people who don't deserve to be there. You know, relative performance evaluation like that, grading on a curve, so to speak, never works, because it ends up creating these dynamics on a team where, you know, people don't want to be with the best performers, because, you know, if you're pretty good at your job, but you're with all the superstars, then, you know, you're going to end up being in that top bottom 10%. So it kind of creates these skewed incentives that aren't good for any organization. And it's also just unfair. You know, you could be, you know, still meeting expectations, but because everybody else on your team is doing even better than you, you end up getting cut, even though you're doing a perfectly fine job. So those are the problems with, you know, that kind of, you know, arbitrariness of saying like the bottom 10% always has to go. Of course, like, you know, if you're not pulling your weight on a team, or if, you know, the role is obviously a bad match for your skills. Yeah. Like, you know, there are cases where, you know, it is in the best interest for the business to push you out. But, you know, that probably should involve a process where, you know, the managers first try to coach the employees to become better. That's why we, you know, have a process of performance improvement plans, right? I mean, when an employee isn't performing well, that's not just on the employee. There's, you know, that's also on the company. It's also on management for failing to, you know, appropriately coach the employee, or maybe, you know, placing the employee in the wrong role in the first place.
Well, so Mark Zuckerberg lets go 4,000 employees last month. And if Facebook is having sufficient trouble, if it's a profitability issue or whatever, then it's certainly incumbent upon them to do what's right. Cut employees, say. I understand why you would want to or have to fire some people. And of course, you would start with the lowest performing people. But if it's just a company policy That to me is the real terrifying thing. It's like maybe the company is profitable this year. We're all doing fine, but yeah, somebody's on top and somebody's on the bottom. I could see how that would breed a an air of low morale. That would hurt morale. You wonder if that would be a good policy to have. That's what you're writing about.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is, you know, this isn't an unforeseeable problem. You know, one of Facebook's competitors, Microsoft, did this really not that long ago. Just over 10 years ago, it had a policy called stack ranking, where it did grade people on a curve like this, and it did aggressively hire people who were in that bottom rank. But it ended up creating this terrible culture within Microsoft that is, you know, widely blamed for, you know, a lot of the missteps that Microsoft made in, you know, the early 2000s and the early 2010s, because it was just such a terrible workplace that people were sabotaging each other all the time.
Right.
You know, the employees had really low morale. So Microsoft got rid of that policy saying, okay, like, this is a mistake. And the irony is even a company like Microsoft that knows this is bringing this policy back.
Jack Welch was the one who said, let's just eliminate the bottom 20% as a rule. I'm out of time now, but just give me the headline on, well, what are some motivational things that do work? If it's not fear and terror, what should or can companies do to get those bottom performers to perform better?
Yeah, the irony is organizational psychologists have been doing research on this for an entire century now. These factors are very well known. It's things like, you know, doing work that contributes to the common good. It's, you know, having a sense of social community, having interesting and varied tasks on the job. You know, these aren't very complicated things. It's really not rocket science.
Aki Ito writes for BusinessInsider.com, chief correspondent there and frequent guest on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks a lot, Aki.
Thanks so much.
More business news now. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Electric vehicle sales are up in Illinois. Total registrations in the first 2 months of 2025 were up 37%, according to Cranes, as consumer and corporate buyers took advantage of incentives. Nationally, that figure was up just 12% compared to a year ago. The Trump administration has threatened to rescind a $7,500 federal tax rebate for EVs, and consumers have been rushing to make purchases. Additional rebates by ComEd have spurred corporate purchases. Overall vehicle sales have been slower. A new survey shows more Chicago area residents see retail crime as a serious problem, and it's causing them to do more shopping online. The Flock Safety and Zen City survey shows a majority of local consumers now prefer to shop online. 49% of area residents say retail crime is a serious problem, compared with 30% nationally. A Council on Criminal Justice report found shoplifting in Chicago was up 46% from January through October of 2024, compared with the same time period the year before. I'm Steve Brzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Wow, that's a number. Here's the business of food. And Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And here's a motto we can all get behind.
Eat well, do good.
Eat well, do good. That's part of an ongoing strategy to save the Great Lakes from invasive carp, which have been renamed Copi. C-O-P-I. Where'd that name come from?
It is a play off the word copious, which is what these fish are.
Yeah, ask anyone who's been in a boat on the Illinois River where dozens of carp fly and jump into boats. That's the sound from some of our WGNers riding the river several years ago.
I just got whacked in the back of the head.
More about Copi and new efforts to try to get you to eat them.
It's very tasty.
After I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today, there has never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDrivesChicago.com. Brian Shonan has quite a title.
I am the Aquatic Nuisance Species Program Manager for the state of Illinois.
And at the top of the nuisance list is the invasive carp, what used to be known as Asian carp. Now it's Copi. Millions of state and federal tax dollars have been spent trying to keep the fish out of the Great Lakes. But the best weapon in the battle?
Some sort of incentivized commercial fishing.
Which has created opportunity and money for the commercial fishing industry as they haul nets full of Copi out of the rivers, turn turning it into
fish oil, fish meal, fertilizer,
and in pet food and human food.
It's very nutrient rich. I mean, it makes sense to use it as a human protein source.
Shonan says the key is maintaining a consistent supply.
If you're going to stick it in every grocery store in the country, the distributor's going to want to know that, okay, I'm going to get X thousand pounds of this fish every week.
Now, the knock on carp is that it's bony and you won't get any fillets out of it, but that isn't stopping at least one Chicago chef.
Actually, it's a savory, clean fish. If you compare it to tilapia, it's got much more flavor.
And I'll have more from Maurice Jackson, who is head chef at Bar 19, as we get closer to the grand opening for Bar 19, scheduled for April 15th. Meanwhile, for more info on Kopi,
choosekopi.com.
And remember, when you're eating Kopi, you
eat well, do good.
On the food calendar, it's National Spanish Paella Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
We're back with more from Villa Park on the Your Hometown Tour. From its rich history to its local favorites, like the original Portillo's. Stay tuned, and we'll show you why Villa Park is one of Chicagoland's best-kept secrets. Sponsored by Illinois Lottery, doing good and supporting Illinois communities, by Captain Demo's Big Truffle Hot Sauce, and by the Captain's Room. Here's John Williams.
Yeah. So there you are in Villa Park, and you want to open up a coffee shop. So what's the clever name you're going to give it? Well, of course, it would be Villa Perk Coffee. What a good idea. Now the head bottle washer, dishwasher, and owner of that place is Brandon Schreiner. Hi, Brandon. You're on WGN.
Hey there. How you doing?
Pretty good. So I get the feeling you wear all the hats over there, huh?
I wear a lot of hats, but I got a great crew, and they definitely make my life easier and do a great job. Putting out coffee and making everybody happy.
And you've been doing that for a year. You got an anniversary coming up Saturday, right?
Oh, no. It's been about a year and a half. Yep, we opened in September, so it'll be about 2 years coming up September.
Yeah, I'm reading a story about the anniversary that you did have. But so you're a couple years old, and business is going pretty good, huh?
Yeah, definitely. We feel very welcomed and supported by the community.
Took a lot to get that place up and running, though, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It took about a year and a half. I actually did the math. We have a very special day coming up. We might celebrate it somehow. But April 11th marks the day that we have been open for as long as it took us to build the coffee shop.
Yeah, so, well, that's kind of a dark reminder. But it wasn't just because you opened up a place, but you wanted a kind of an upscale place, and you wanted to restore the building a little bit, right?
Yeah, definitely. We wanted to do it right. There was the previous tenants had been a therapy type place, so it was not built out to do any sort of hospitality or coffee or anything like that. So it took a little while to get everything torn down and put back together. And of course, with old buildings, you never know what's behind the walls. So we had to do some restoration and upkeep. So we got it done, and it was totally worth it. Yeah, it's been a really fun year and a half since we've been able to open our doors and start serving coffee.
You're serving coffee, but you've also got some signature blends, right? It says here there is a drink called the Pancake Latte. Do you still serve Pancake Latte coffee?
We do. That's probably my favorite menu item. We have a Pancake Latte. We get pretty creative with some of our ingredients and how we put our recipes together. The pancake latte is probably my favorite because we put real butter in it. So,
is there maple syrup in there too? I mean, I'm imagining.
Yeah, you got it. It's maple flavor, vanilla, and then in the hot ones, we'll put butter in it, and it just kind of melts in there, and it's fantastic.
Was that your best seller? I imagine just a black coffee is probably your best seller, huh?
Right now, it's cold brew. You know, we hit cold brew season, and people are looking for iced coffee, so cold brew is really popular. We do sell a lot of black coffee and plain lattes. People like just the flavor of our plain coffee, so that's really exciting. But, a lot of the flavored drinks, they come and go. You know, the pancake latte is really popular. We've got a banana bread latte that's also really popular that also uses some butter, and that's got some banana and hazelnut flavors. But we like to do rotations and make kind of creative, fun drinks. And so we see those things cycle in and out depending on the season.
Do you serve some food also, or are you just a coffee store?
We have pastries from local bakeries.
Yeah.
Croissants are out of this world. We've got some really great danishes, muffins, scones, that sort of thing.
I think we've all been to more than a couple of coffee places, and I've talked to more than a few folks who run them. I have not run into somebody that's serving the sort of concoctions you are. Straight coffee, but also signature drinks. What a good idea, Brandon.
Hey, thank you so much. You know, we opened, like I said, a year and a half ago, and this is a new venture for me. I've never worked in a coffee shop before, but I've always enjoyed cooking and making coffee at home. So I think in some ways, not having a rule set in
right.
front of me has helped me to put some creative ideas out there. So
Brandon Schreiner is the owner, and I'm just reading this now, head dishwasher of Villa Perk Coffee. Visit villaperkcoffee.com and Villa Park. Well done, Brandon. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
You too.